teachings of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, they are those people who have listened to his advice, and today they are the supporters of Islamic revolution. And alhamdulillah, we're enjoying the support of so many Muslim brothers across the globe. The Sunnis are backing the Shias are backing the Sunnis.
Thank you very much for your time and insight, Said Husseini, the director of the Islamic Center for Africa.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been involved in many humanitarian activities across Africa, including setting up colleges and universities, medical clinics, and agricultural projects which directly benefit the masses. One such project is the Iran Clinic in Ghana's capital, Accra. Speaking during the inauguration of the refurbished clinic, the country's vice president lauded the contributions of the Iranian government to the health sector of Ghana.
The Iran Clinic has got a long history in Ghana, and it is really one of the benefits and the lasting benefits, I hope, of this close relationship between the government and people of Iran and the government of people of Ghana. And I think that what we are seeing here in the Iran clinic, 300 patients at least every day come through here. Every day, at least 300 patients. And this is why it comes up to close to 100,000 every year. That is a huge contribution to healthcare in Ghana that the Red Crescent, Iranian Red Crescent, is providing. Huge contribution.
Students, let me say assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. The essence of coming here this morning to interact with you, much has been said by your head teacher. And the issue here this morning is that my ministry, that is the Ministry of Inner City and Zongo Development, is in collaboration with the Iran Clinic to help bring medical attention to your doorsteps.
Iran's development projects in Africa were one of the topics during a roundtable held in Uganda last year to discuss Imam Khomeini's impact on Africa. Let's take a listen to one of the participants.
We are seeing schools, universities opened in African capitals. They were not there before the revolution. A country like Iran giving support, and it was very wealthy by then, giving support to other countries like it is doing now, it was not there. I've said politically, it stood with the Africans against racism in South Africa. We have seen, even politically, opening embassies. All these embassies we are seeing in Africa were not there before the revolution. When this revolution came, and they wanted to know more about problems of the African communities, African countries, all of these embassies were opened so that they interact with the populations, get how we can exchange, cultural exchange, commerce, and political integration.
Now, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki, how have the thoughts of Imam Khomeini contributed to the progress of Muslims in Nigeria?
Especially when the Islamic Revolution succeeded, this brought about a kind of, in some cases very directly, like I can say, for example, in the Islamic movement and for other people as well, but also in some cases very indirectly, that people are much more, I believe, comfortable with comfortably expressing interest in an Islamic system, potentially in Islam, not just as a private thing for people, for individuals, and also for Islam, even in a political sense and other things. And I think that has had a great effect on Nigeria, especially when we look at the Islamic movement, which is heavily influenced by Imam and the Imam's revolution and the Imam's writings and the Imam's thoughts and everything, and his whole life entirely, basically.
Imam Imam Khomeini had unique leadership qualities which endeared him to the masses in Iran and across the world. He introduced himself as the servant of the people and considered the people a source of blessing. The Imam was a serious supporter of the poor and the oppressed, and he forcefully and bitterly rejected economic inequality and aristocracy. In one of his previous speeches, the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria says the world needs to emulate Imam Khomeini, as he was a unique leader.
Some people think that just as we have Imam Khomeini in Iran, other Muslim countries should have their own Khomeini type leader. You know, I heard someone was saying they need their own Khomeini. And he was saying they need Khomeinis. Look, the world, the whole world, the entire world needs only one Khomeini, and it has one. What it remains for the world is to follow the teaching of Imam Khomeini. You cannot talk of Imam Khomeini being a former leader or an older leader. He's still the leader. And alhamdulillah, he has got a successor in the person of Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Hafizahullah, where the teaching of the Imam continue as if it is the Imam himself is alive.
Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today, and it's been great having you with us. Tell us what you think about our show by dropping us a line through our social media handle. And on behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, goodbye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
In the limelight. Today, the threat to democracies in the West and elsewhere is from within. The crisis of Western democracies is purely internal and not a product of Russia or China. We now present you an article written by Bim Bortel, visiting faculty for a Master's in International Relations and Diplomacy at Tripuvan University in Kathmandu, Nepal. The piece is titled Biden's Call for Democratic Values, Alliance is Hollow Rhetoric. U.S. President Joe Biden is wrapping up his first foreign trip to Europe as President of the United States to reclaim the so-called global leadership role that his predecessor, Donald Trump, abandoned after taking office in January of 2017. Joe Biden tried to renew relations with European NATO members and with other allies. To reclaim his country's so-called vanguard role, Joe Biden used the slogan, "The United States is back." During the trip, in most of his speeches, Joe Biden claimed that cooperation and partnership among the Group of Seven and other invitees to last weekend's G7 summit, such as Australia, India, Japan, and South Africa, as well as other U.S. allies, are based on specific values. Biden claimed that the United States alliances and partnerships are based on human rights and democratic values. However, he also emphasized that these values are under severe threat from foreign powers. He reiterated that such threats are coming from Vladimir Putin of Russia and Xi Jinping of China. Joe Biden's claim is not new. It is a continuation of Donald Trump's foreign policy. The slight difference is that Trump was perceived as soft on Russia and tough on China. Biden wanted to give an impression that he's taking a tough stance against Russia as well. To keep American public opinion favorable towards him, Joe Biden's high-level diplomatic acts may be helpful to him domestically, but there was a lot of noise and pomp and very little substance. Biden is doing precisely what a right-wing populist like Donald Trump would do. To avoid taking responsibility for their citizens' well-being, to cover up their grave failures and to distract public attention from their own severe botches, right-wing populists and nationalists use such tactics worldwide. Unfortunately, Joe Biden has continued the same strategy. Biden and his team are well aware that democracy is now on the defensive all over the world, in developed as well as in developing countries. The democratic system of governance is more in crisis than after the Great Depression of the 1930s. Perhaps the Biden team are not unaware that Nazism and fascism sprouted in Germany and Italy as the unintended consequences of Western democracy. Those political systems developed as external threats to the so-called free world across the Atlantic. Today, the threat of the democracies in the West and elsewhere is from within. The crisis of Western democracies is purely internal and not a product of Russia or China. Ultra-nationalist and right-wing populist leaders such as Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson in the United Kingdom, Donald Trump in the United States, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil have been tampering with democratic norms and democratic values. They are the products of the internal failures of democracy. Biden, in his address on 9th of June to U.S. Air Force personnel and their families stationed at Royal Air Force in Mildenhall, quoting the Declaration of Independence, said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We mean it. No nation can defeat us as long as we stick to our values." However, democracy has failed to ensure the lives, liberties, and pursuits of happiness of the people, not just in the United States, but in other countries too. The post-2008 financial crisis and the current COVID-19 pandemic have both proved that democracies in the West and in the developing world have failed miserably. For instance, democracy in the United States has failed to protect the lives and liberties of women, people of color, and other minorities. American society is deeply divided today. The hashtag MeToo movement and the Black Lives Matter movement depict a severe lack of human rights and democracy for many people living in the United States. Racism, xenophobia, economic inequality, gun violence, and police brutality are long-standing characteristics of the world's oldest democracy. American democracy primarily contributes to protecting the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for the rich and protects the private property of the wealthy. American democracy, as defined by Abraham Lincoln, of the people, by the people, and for the people, has now been converted into of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%, as depicted by Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. The attack on Capitol Hill on 6th of January this year was the internal outcome of the decline of American democracy. The world's so-called oldest democracy, the United States, the purported mother of parliamentary democracy, the United Kingdom, and South America's largest democracy, Brazil, all failed to protect their citizens from the pandemic. None of the leaders of these democracies were held accountable for their failures. Instead, these leaders claim foreign threats to distract voters from their grave failures. And Joe Biden wants to protect democratic values by way of partnerships and alliances with these very same irresponsible and unaccountable leaders. Every student of political science and government reads in undergraduate textbooks that the most significant merit of a democracy is to be responsible and accountable to its citizens. It is the responsibility of a democratic state to protect its citizens' life, liberty, and property. However, today's democracies are neither accountable to the electorate nor accountable for their grave failures. For example, the world-renowned health science journal The Lancet published 5 articles on the coronavirus outbreak in mid-February of 2020. It warned of its potential public health risks. However, the United States, Brazil, France, and the United Kingdom have some of the highest COVID-19 infection rates per million population. The highest COVID-related death tolls are found in these countries that Joe Biden called like-minded democracies. Do Biden's democratic alliances and partnerships mean collaboration and partnership with the failed, the irresponsible, and the unaccountable? If so, then it looks like democracy has taken the form of an overly worn hat that has lost its shape. If Joe Biden's like-minded democratic partners are Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, Britain's Boris Johnson, and Australia's Scott Morrison, while Biden himself is following in Donald Trump's footsteps on foreign policy, democracy is an alliance and partnership of irresponsible and unaccountable people. In such a case, democracy is entirely hollow and without foundation.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
The last point that I would like to raise is the concerns that I have about the issue of slandering during the time of elections in our country. If the goal of some people is to blind and destroy a deviant line and orientation, this is not the way. Such behavior will not fulfill the purpose. And it is clear what the viewpoint of Sharia is in this regard. Normally, such moves are not free of unintentional insulting, slandering, lies, and ill-informed statements. The Holy Quran says to us, Why did not the believing men and the believing women, when you heard it, think well of their own people and say, This is an evident falsehood? The Holy Quran, chapter 24, verse 12. why do you not trust one another? Why do you not believe one another's statements? Well, if you do not believe in someone, you can avoid implementing their ideas and thoughts. But the act of slandering is very bad. What I want to say about the issues of elections is this. Of course, there are other points about the issues of elections, but I will raise them later on. Everyone should take care not to contaminate elections, particularly the Assembly of Experts elections, by creating an environment for slandering, by accusing individuals and damaging their reputation. This should not be done either in Islamic seminaries or in Tehran and provincial cities. This is one of the issues which everyone should pay attention and attach great significance to. This should be done so that Allah, the Exalted, opens the path and guides the people and their hearts. The hearts of the people are in the hands of God. It is Allah, the Exalted, who bestows on human beings hope, motivation, and the determination to move towards the right tasks and goals. So we should ask Allah, the Exalted, for these things, and we should rely on Him. We should carry out our responsibility and entrust the result to God. Whatever Allah, the Exalted, wants will happen. I hope that what He wants is the product of our intentions and our good deeds. And I hope that it is what we want. We should move forward in this way. I ask Allah the Exalted to guide all of us towards the right and straight path. I hope that He will make our great, revolutionary, religious, and intelligent people more capable and successful in carrying out their responsibilities. I hope that He will increase on a daily basis the achievements that we can witness in scientific, technological, political, economic, and other areas. Greetings be upon you, and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Election day in Iran, people are heading to the polls across the country to choose a new president for the next 4 years. More than 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast ballots. Voters will choose a successor to incumbent president Hassan Rouhani from the four candidates running. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called for high turnout, stressing that a high turnout can help the country gain major advantages at the international level. Incumbent Hassan Rouhani has also called on people from all walks of life to participate in the election. Rouhani said that a high turnout will frustrate Iran's enemies. The Iranian economy and the outcome of the JCPOA negotiations are some of the key issues leading up to the elections. Joining us on tonight's debate, we have political analyst and university professor Fouad Izadi joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Mr. Salmahdi Torabi, joining us also from the Iranian capital. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Mr. Salmahdi Torabi, let's start off with you. Why are these elections so important? What's at stake in today's elections?
Well, as the leader mentioned in his speech a day before, or a couple days before the elections, the most important basis of the revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic was the participation of the people. This was not a revolution that was conducted by officer corps of the military or the vanguard elite of some revolutionary party. It was a revolution that was conducted by the people themselves. And the whole establishment, the whole Islamic Republic is based on the participation of the people. I want to point out something, which is that, of course, the most important election today was the presidential election, but it wasn't only a presidential election. Here in Tehran, we had a very interesting ballot. We had three seats in the Assembly of Experts, which is the body that appoints the Supreme Leader. We had a one by-election in the Majlis, which is the legislative body of the country, and we had the local city council elections with 21 members. So, as you can see, the elections work on all levels, from the local level to the legislature to the executive branch, and even higher than that. That's related to the supreme leadership. And on all levels, the destiny of the country is determined by the vote of the people.
Professor Izadi, welcome to the program. Please give us your perspective on the significance of Iran's presidential election.
Well, the election is significant because it's going to have ramifications internally inside the country and internationally. We have a number of Western governments headed by the United States that have always tried to demonize Iran and question the legitimacy of Iran's elections. You know, in political science, we have this democratic peace theory, which says that democracies don't have conflicts. And since the United States have been fighting the Iranian people for many, many years, by definition, Iran cannot have a democracy, cannot be a democracy. And if you have millions of people participating in elections, then that needs to be delegitimized, and so the popular backing of the government should not be presented internationally. So the election process or results or the fact that people are coming to the polls needs to not be known to the outside world. And by doing that, they can say that Iran's government doesn't have legitimacy, and that way they can basically justify this economic warfare that they have been conducting against Iranian people. So that's why the election is important. If we have enough international media covering the elections the way they are and presenting the facts about Iran, that's going to make the job of people like Biden more difficult. And that's the basic aim. Internally, there are obviously differences between different candidates. So you had Dr. Hemati, who was saying that he is a technocrat. His domestic policy, economic policy, is very much inspired by the neoliberal political and economic thought internationally. And he was going to follow Rouhani's foreign policy as well. In fact, he was probably going to keep Dr. Zarif as the foreign minister if he gets elected. On the other hand, you had someone like Mr. Raisi that comes from this liberation theology background. He's a theologian, he's a cleric, and in line with what the Islamic Republic started with, helping the poor, these type of clerics, that follow the revolutionary or political Islam, say that we have a responsibility for the poor. So if you paid attention to the debates, you saw that he was talking a lot about the poor and helping the poor, and that's where he comes from. So he's not a technocrat, and he hopefully is going to learn from the experiences of the Rouhani administration for the last 8 years when it comes to foreign policy.
Mr. Tarabia, why are certain countries trying to undermine Iran's elections and its democratic efforts?
Sure. I mean, I think it's clear that when you look at the region and when you look at the way that the governments in the region are constellated, the reason that, for example, you have certain tribal rulers and family rulers in Saudi Arabia, Emirates, etc., existing is because of the support of the Americans. So what they fear the most is a Republican system of governments and a system of governance where the people get to decide who's the ruler. If you look at a place like Bahrain, the whole reason you had the revolution in Bahrain, which was violently and suppressed, was because there was a person who had been the prime minister for 41 years, who happened to be the uncle of the king, and the Americans and the Saudis insisted that the Saudis insisted that he remain as the prime minister, even though there were parliamentary elections in Bahrain that gave the majority to other parties, but the rulership was not willing to change that because the Americans and the Saudis were not happy about that. So the point is that the reason the enemies of Iran, whether it's the Americans or their local lackeys in the region, don't like the elections in Iran is because it shows their dictatorship. It shows to the world that they are dictators, and it shows to the world that they are racist apartheid states like in Israel, because if you had an actual election in Israel where you included 48 Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, you would have a majority of Palestinians and non-Zionist Jews if you include the ultra-Orthodox and some of the secular left-wing Jews that live in Israel, and you might not even have a Zionist state. So the biggest danger for America and the local rulers that are its lackeys is when the people get to vote. That's why they've been, doing propaganda against the Islamic Republic and elections in Iran for 42 years, because it shows their own weakness. And of course, the good thing about the times that we live in is that maybe 40 years ago, with very limited media and very limited information that people had access to, you could have gotten away with lying about what the reality is. But we live in a world where information is transmitted very quickly, where people themselves can take the films and the different information that they can gather and pass it to other people around the world. And it's very clear to everyone now that the only country in the region where there's any sort of meaningful participation of the people is Iran. One could include Turkey also in this, but there are issues with Turkey. If you look at the way, for example, Erdogan has turned it into a pretty much a personal presidential we don't want to call it a dictatorship, but very, very authoritarian. And previous to that, of course, you had the army ruling in Turkey, whether it was in the background or openly, as they did after the coup in 1980. So the only country in the region where the people matter, where, as I mentioned previously, at every level of governance, beginning from the supreme leadership all the way down to the local level, it is the people who decide who runs the country and what policies are made for the future.
Professor Izadi, why are some Western countries adamant in trying to delegitimize Iran's elections?
Well, because they want to pressure the Iranian people, and by sort of questioning the legitimacy of Iran's election, they can follow and continue that policy. The fact that you have a significant portion of the population, we don't know how many people will show up on today's election, but generally Iran's elections attract more than 50% of the population. That has been, Iran has had 39 elections in the last 42 years, and with the exception of one, all of them attracted more than 50%. We have had cases in some years that the number of participants reached to 75-80% of the people who were eligible to vote. So if people realize internationally that majority of Iranians trust the system of government in Iran, that they go and stand in the polls for sometimes hours to cast the ballot, that shows that the government has legitimacy. And the fact that Iran's government has legitimacy gives it power in international arenas. And sanctioning this government is going to be more difficult. So what countries like the United States have to do is to question the legitimacy of the government and ignore the fact that there is this very significant popular support for the government. And interestingly, this is one of the things that people in Iran have realized. So when reporters talk to people who are standing in lines, a lot of times this issue of the fact that they're in lines because they want to send a message to the United States comes up. So what the U.S. is actually doing by interfering in Iran's domestic affairs, it's actually providing a reason for people to go to the polls. People who may not have gone to the polls because of economic difficulties that they have and other issues. You know, this year there was this concern about the voter participation because of two main reasons. One was COVID-19, you know, that crowded places, when you go and cast the vote, there's a chance you may get sick. So that was one concern, that people would not go out. And the second concern was that the people who voted for President Rouhani 4 years ago and 8 years ago and are not happy with his performance, and there are very few people in Iran that are happy with his performance, they may not want to vote for the other party, other camp. So they may decide to stay at home, because they don't want to vote for Rouhani, they don't want to vote for Rouhani's line, they don't want to vote, for example, for Mr. Hemmati, and they don't want to vote for the other side. The reason they don't want to vote for Mr. Hemmati is because they're not happy with the way Rouhani conducted his government. And so there was this concern that people may not come to the polls as much as they did before because of these two reasons. So, and we have to wait and see basically how many people will show up.
So, Matthew Torab, you mentioned the issue of voter turnout and the people's presence. Those are comments that were also echoed by Ayatollah Khamenei. Also, many observers, they maintain that a strong voter turnout, it displays national unity against the enemies. The Iranian president, the incumbent president, said that a strong turnout will frustrate the adversaries of the Islamic Republic and can foil plots of Iran's enemies. Unpack that for us.
Sure. I mean, I think most of the issue was discussed by Dr. Izadi, and I don't know if there's any much more I can add to that. The reality is that Iranians need no foreign or outside reason to go to the polls, because we have a 100-year history of people being martyred, executed, tortured for us to have the vote. It started more than 100 years ago with the Constitutional Revolution, which then ended up in the Pahlavi dictatorship as installed by the English. Then in the 50s, we had the Mossadegh nationalist government, again overthrown in a coup by the Americans. And then finally, in the late 70s, we had the establishment of the Islamic Republic, which for the first time allowed the Iranian people to have a vote. So for us, having the vote came with a very, very high price. Our grandfathers, our fathers, our great-grandfathers, our grandfathers, our fathers, and mothers, and great-grandmothers and grandmothers were, suffered a lot for this. So yes, of course, as we look at our own history, we understand those who actually know their history know why they have to go vote, whether it's to, live up to that legacy as it relates to the British at the beginning of the 20th century, or as it relates to the interferences by the Americans in the late 20th century. And these things didn't change after the revolution. They didn't change. The Americans and their allies, the Europeans, and their local lackeys did not suddenly decide, oh, yes, okay, we accept the fact that the Iranians have decided that they want to have a republic and not have an absolute monarchy for 2,500 years. We accept the fact that the Iranians don't want to live in a semi-feudal country with 30% literacy, which is what it was in the year that I was born, 1972. There was 30% literacy and 70% illiteracy in this country. And anybody who has a brain, anybody whose rational thinking capabilities are not in some way distorted, can tell the difference between the Iran that we have today and the Iran that existed 42 years ago when the revolution happened. So, yes, of course, those countries whose goal and stated goal for over 100 years is to control West Asia, which is the most important strategic area of the world. West Asia, according to the Westerners, this is not my claim, this is their own analysis that they have been telling the world for over 100 years. The most important strategic area of the world is West Asia. And guess what? The heart of West Asia is Iran. So whoever rules Iran, again, not my analysis, this is what they're saying, whoever rules Iran and West Asia rules the world, because that person, that country or that alliance is able to control the flow of everything from east to west, is capable of shutting down oil and any sort of strategic whether it's in the air or whether it's in the sea, any sort of strategic and military going back and forth between north and south, east and west. And so, of course, they are very hurt by the fact that they lost Iran. They had hoped with the Pahlavi regime to have their local bully here, which they call the local gendarme, to be able to go and kill whoever they want in the region, but not get their own hands dirty. Something that, for example, the Saudis or the Israelis are now doing more and have taken over. And very recently, unfortunately, the Emiratis, as we see in Yemen. And so when they lost that, they lost the crown jewel of their West Asian empire or their global empire. And they can't handle it. They can't get over it. Whether the Iranians want to have Dr. Rouhani or Dr. Ahmadinejad or Dr. Khatami or whoever as the president, they don't care. The important thing to them is whoever comes into power is put under pressure, and that somehow in their deranged analysis, they think this is like the Soviet Union or East Europe at the end of the Cold War, where somehow if people are, driven to starvation, they will rise up. First of all, we're not driven to starvation. During the worst sanctions in human history, again, as claimed by themselves, we've had the most significant technological advances. We don't have widespread hunger. We don't have desperation. The only thing we have is we have those countries not wanting to accept that Iran takes its position as the natural hegemon of West Asia, that Iran takes its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization. As we saw, as the leader pointed out in his speech, in the middle of all the sanctions and all the maximum pressure, we are one of the few countries that has developed not only one, but four or five, I don't even know now, four or five vaccines against COVID, which, sure, inshallah, will be passing out. So again, it's about Iran not being powerful and Iran not taking its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization, and they can't handle it. And that's why they they do what they do for all these years.
Professor Izadi, I'd like to get your thoughts on what Mr. Torabi just mentioned. You know, the United States at the helm of the Western world, they claim to be advocates of democracy, but looking at their track record in the region, putting the magnifying glass on the region, I know it transcends West Asia, but just focusing on the Middle East, they don't want democracy in the region. As Mr. Torabi pointed out, the 1953 coup in Iran shows that as well. Can you explain that that double standards that we're seeing from the United States?
Well, they actually have to explain what they are doing, because they very much like the Shah regime, they like the monarchies in southern states in the Persian Gulf, and they don't like Iran, that has one of the thriving democracies in this region and internationally. So the double standards need to be explained by the other side. The fact that there is a republic now after many centuries of the monarchy system is something that people cherish. So with all the difficulties that people have in Iran, they like the fact that they get a chance to vote. You know, I thought Khamenei talked about this fact that there are some of these monarchies around the Persian Gulf don't do any elections at all. And they're financing television channels based in London that are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls, and they are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls because they claim that Iran's government is not democratic enough. So what Ayatollah Khamenei was saying is that the countries that are paying for these channels don't know the difference between the ballot box and a fruit box, because they don't do elections in for these countries to want to undermine Iran's democracy is going to be something very foolish. And for governments like the United States to be supporting these countries and then fighting Iran, that's also very foolish. It hasn't worked. The U.S. policy towards Iran has been a major failure in the last 42 years. And with people's participation, Iran will maintain a standing and will ensure that the U.S. policies will continue to fail. And the sooner American officials realize the facts about Iran, the sooner they realize that the people of Iran are not going to accept a government like Shah's government. They're not going to do that. They're not going to allow their government to be run by the United States. The sooner they realize that, better it's going to be for them, because the failed policies of the past has also hurted them at the same time that they have hurted the public in Iran.
And Samati Torabi, very briefly, if you may, Mr. Izadi just brought up an interesting point there about the United States criticizing other countries' elections. The Electoral College, that's a mess. The recent presidential elections in the United States, it was chaotic. I don't have the proper words to say what it was. It was a bunch of political shenanigans being played out. The United States is not really in a position to criticize anybody's elections, is it?
Absolutely not. Anybody who's lived in the States like we have knows that, especially in those areas that are controlled by Democrats, we have almost 100 and sometimes longer 100-year history of the mafia and the local mob working with the Democratic Party to vote for whoever they want to do. I don't have the facts to show you that there was fraud, but I am positive that there was fraud in many of those states like Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin or New York or New Jersey or Florida. So these are things that anybody who's lived in America knows. The fact that you don't have the empire media, the boot-licking media of America, you know, talking about these things, well, you know, maybe that's the problem. It's not that the American people don't know, and if you, the polls have been conducted, up to 70% of Republican voters, in some polls it's 50%, do not consider Biden to be a legitimately elected president. You know, I don't want to talk about that maybe that much, because, hey, whatever, if the Americans, you know, think that that's a problem, it's their responsibility to have a revolution, like we had a revolution.
Okay,
so inshallah they will have a revolution.
All right, I'm sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, political analyst and university professor Fouad Izadi joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also thanks to Director Rasolat Strategic Studies Institute, Mr. Salmati Torabi, also speaking to us from the Iranian capital. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's debate. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem.